University of California Television presents this podcast of My Life So Far with Jane Fonda. This talk was recorded in May 2006 at the UC Santa Barbara campus. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
The Center is delighted to co-sponsor Jane Fonda's talk with Arts and Lectures. As Celeste said, it's only by pooling our resources that we can pull off the wonderful events such as the one we have here tonight. We're also delighted to welcome Jane Fonda back to Santa Barbara, This is, after all, one of her favorite old haunts. Those of us who've already read her number one New York Times bestseller, My Life So Far, will have a chance tonight to hear the embodiment of the strong, clear voice in that remarkable book. And those of you who haven't yet had the chance to read My Life So Far will get a moving preview. Jane Fonda will herself be telling you about her life so far. But I do want to mention a few notable distinctions. She attended the Emma Willard School and Vassar College, and later studied with Lee Strasberg and became a member of the Actors Studio in New York. Her work on stage and screen earned her numerous honors, including two Best Actress Academy Awards in 1971 for Clute, in 1978 for Coming Home. She also has an Emmy for her role in The Dollmaker. She's also been a successful producer of films, including The China Syndrome, 9 to 5, of which we're always hoping for a remake, On Golden Pond, and The Morning After. Yeah. We all know that she revolutionized the fitness industry with the release of Jane Fonda's Workout in 1982, and I believe it is still the top-grossing home video of all time. Jane Fonda has always been an activist. She's now an activist and philanthropist. In 1995, she founded the Georgia Campaign for Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention and opened the Jane Fonda Center. And opened the Jane Fonda Center for Adolescent Reproductive Health at Emory University's School of Medicine. Jane Fonda is now a citizen of the great city of Atlanta, but she will always be an honorary citizen of Santa Barbara. Let's welcome Jane Fonda.
Thank you. Thanks. Thank you very much. Thank you. It's really great to be here. I've spent a chunk of my second act in these parts. And by the way, the dog is... I got the dog last year. I never had a small dog before, but I knew I was going to be spending a lot of time touring for my book, and I needed something to help me not miss my grandkids. Her name is Tulia. Tulia, sit down. Oh, well, she will eventually lie down. And, you know, and I was thinking about being here and being a grandmother, because it seems such a short time ago that my children grew up at the Laurel Springs camp up at the top of the San Marcos Pass in Painted Cave. My husband then, Tom Hayden, and I had the camp for 15 years. I think that the people who ran it are here. David Hodges and Laurel Lyle, are you here? I learned so much during those 15 years of that camp. And I had no idea why I was learning what I was learning. It was an unusual camp because of the diversity. There would be daughters of the heads of studios bunking with girls who had never had a bed of their own. There was, I remember in particular, there was one year where there was a bunking. There were like four young gang member wannabes from East LA, real macho, you know. And then there was this very white-skinned, tow-headed boy with MS who had to be carried everywhere. And by the end of that summer, watching this blonde kid getting himself to swim across the pool, you could see that for those wannabe gang members, the notion of manhood had been changed. They applauded his bravery and understood bravery in a new way. I learned that a fourth of the kids that went to the school, the girls, fourth of the girls had been sexually abused. Same statistics as in the country. I ended up adopting one of the girls, an African-American girl named Lulu, who had been coming to the camp since she was 12. And when she came to live with us, I said to her one day, "Lulu, why was the camp such an important experience to you?" And she thought for the briefest minute, and she said, "It was the first time in my life that I had ever met people who thought about the future." That was a transforming statement for me. As usual, I learned and the counselors learned more from the campers, I'm sure, than they did from us. And it informs the work that I do now. People who see a future for themselves don't engage in super risky behavior. Little girls and little boys who feel safe and think they're going to live past 20 and have a future that beckons, they don't have babies when they're still babies. So that it has a lot to do with the work I'm doing now. There's someone else in the audience tonight. His name is Fred Bramfman. I'm very moved that he's here and that I saw him earlier. I got to know Fred in 1971. Fred Bramfman single-handedly exposed the fact that the U.S. government had been carrying on a secret bombing of the Plain of Jars in Laos, wiping out an entire civilization. He did a book called Voices of the Plain of Jars, and he exposed the secret war and became a very, very respected researcher and testifier to what the U.S. was doing in Indochina. And when Tom Hayden and I formed the Indochina Peace Campaign, it was Fred who researched and developed the materials that we used as we traveled around the country, basically rebuilding a movement. Now, it's important. I just want to talk about this for a second because it's very relevant to today. Nixon very brilliantly had devised this Vietnamization program. You know, we'll turn it over to the Vietnamese, and we're going to bring home the ground troops, and he did. And what happened was that most Americans thought the war was ending. There were fewer and fewer body bags coming back, fewer and fewer guys going over. What we didn't know, unless we were really paying close attention, was that the war was escalating from the air, unbeknownst to us, with newer and more heinous kinds of bombs being dropped, more Indochinese dying. This is the kind of thing that Fred Bramfman was able to expose. Two things about this that I want to say in relationship to what's happening today. One is we have to be real vigilant in the next period of time. It may well be that the ground troops come home, I hope. But will there be a continuing air war? I don't know how many of you read Seymour Hersh's article in The New Yorker of not so long ago. It was very, very important. You know, Seymour Hersh is the reporter that exposed the My Lai massacre. He's a brilliant reporter who revealed just now, recently, the fact that with our tax dollars, the Pentagon is building huge air bases in Iraq. Anwar province, for example, 17,000 acres, huge walls all around, multi-cineplexes, Burger King, you know, hairdressing shops. It's like a little colony of Americana walled in from which airplanes fly. And there apparently will be more of those, and most Americans may not ever know about it. Just like most Americans aren't aware of the fact that hundreds and thousands of Iraqis were killed between the first Gulf War and the second, the current Iraqi War. And many of them died from cancer because we were bombing with bombs that had depleted uranium tips on them. And our soldiers, in large numbers, have gotten cancer. There's a lot of stuff going on that we need to know about. The other thing that I think is relevant for today is that with the help of many people, probably in this room, certainly many people in Santa Barbara and in communities all around the country, a new anti-war movement was built. It was really like connecting the dots. Groups and individuals and small groups all around the country who were kind of isolated and were coalesced into something very simple. The demand is cut off the funds for the war. And so a letter-writing campaign and a lobbying campaign was launched. And it was unbelievable. When some of us, including Fred Branfman and Tom Hayden and I and others, went to Washington to lobby at the end of 4 months of this, congresspeople would say to us, call them off, stop, we're going to vote with you, we're going to cut the funds. And they did, and the war ended. That to say that, you know, everyone's saying, well, who are we going to nominate? What candidate are you going to support? Who's going to be our candidate? Let's not think so much about that. Let's think about pressuring the government and rebuilding a movement that is going to force whoever the candidate is to be brave. Because without a grassroots movement, they're not going to be brave. And they pay attention. When they come home, go to their offices in large numbers, write letters, send emails, keep the pressure on. They do pay attention. Thanks for being here, Fred. There's somebody else here tonight, Professor Dick Flax, who I've known for many decades. And I want to announce something. Starting this coming Friday, 4 days from now, there's going to be a conference. It's called 45 Years of Activism. It's going to take place in Corwin Pavilion. It starts Friday afternoon at 3:30. Friday night, there's a dinner at USEN, Corwin Pavilion. It starts at 6:30. And Saturday, starting at 10 all day, the conference continues. This is honoring the retirement of Dick Flax from UCSB. And there is a fund that is being created called the Dick Flax Democracy Fund to support faculty and student research on democratic possibilities. I know that Dick Flax has made a huge difference in the lives of many young people who have come through this university in the last many decades, and I hope that we can all honor him with our presence at these events next Friday. When I was 59 years old, I realized that a year hence, I was going to be 60. And, you know, I realized that if I was going to live, which I assume I am, into my 90s, that it was going to be the beginning of my third act. First 30 years, second 30 years, last 30 years. Third acts are important. You can have really chaotic, confused mishmash of two acts beforehand, and then the third act can pull it all together and make sense of it, or not. And something important had happened to me about 25 years earlier. I had watched my father die. He died over a prolonged period of time from a complicated heart disease. And actually, he died 5 months after coming home. No, it was the other one. After On Golden Pond came out, he died 5 months later. But it's an important experience to sit by the bedside of a beloved parent, especially a parent that you've had complicated relationship with. So many of you I know have seen On Golden Pond. Well, that was me and my dad. Very complicated, but I loved him dearly. And sitting there wishing that he would talk to me, I so wanted to ask him, "Are you scared?" I wanted to ask him, "Can you see across? Are there angels?" Well, you know, but my stepmother didn't want to admit that he was dying, and so I couldn't do that. But I learned an important lesson sitting there. I learned that I'm not afraid of dying. On the contrary, I have, as Fred Braffman, who is here, would say, I have a life-affirming death awareness. The older I get, the more I realize the importance of living with the awareness of our immortality. Of our mortality, of the awareness of that we're going to die, because it changes our conception of how we're going to do life. Death makes sense of life. And I really that hasn't changed. I'm not afraid of dying. What I'm terrified of, however, is getting to the end of life with regrets. I knew that my father was going out with regrets, and it was too late for him to do anything about it. So 25 years later, I'm looking into 60, and I'm thinking, well, what would my regrets be? Because I got to figure out what the regrets would be so that I can live my third act in such a way that I, you know, will minimize them at the end of my life. I also wanted to understand what the first two acts had been about. You know, I didn't want to be like Christopher Columbus, who didn't know where he was going when he left, didn't know where he was when he got there, and didn't know where he'd been when he got back. And so I had this idea. I decided I was going to make a movie of my life, as though it was somebody else, a video, a 25-minute video of my life, and I was going to spend my 59th year researching myself. And my daughter, Vanessa, is a documentary filmmaker, so I asked her, you know, to help me put the video together. You know what she said? Well, why don't you just get a chameleon and let it crawl across the screen? We have a prickly relationship. She has always been my Jiminy Cricket. She can always put her finger on what it is I have to deal with, and I knew I'm going to have to deal with this. And I wasn't sure, because I knew that that's the rap on me, you know, that I'm just a figment of the desires or needs or wants of the man I'm with at the given time. And I thought, I wondered if it was true. Is there a there or not? And so that was one of the things I had to find out. And, you know, it wasn't difficult doing the research because all the important people in my life have either written their own autobiography or had biographies written about them. My father has always been a home movie buff, so there was a lot of home movies, and there were all those interviews since I was 20, you know, on print media and television and radio and ad nauseum. And then there were the 22,000 pages of FBI files, in case I forgot anything. And so it wasn't difficult. What was difficult was that I was married to my favorite ex-husband, and he is a man who didn't like it when I was focused on something other than him. And so I had to do what many women do. I had to pretend to be not doing what I was doing. And most of this, you know, I was able to do in the summertime, this research, because the summer times we would be in Montana, at one of the three places in Montana, all of which had rivers, and we would fish together. So I would slip my laptop into the fishing vest, and we'd go out and get to the stretch of river we were going to fish that day, and he'd go one way, and I'd go the other, and the minute he was out of sight, I'd go behind a tree and pull out my my laptop and write until the battery went dead, and then fish like hell so I'd have something to report. And and the outcome of this was not what I expected. There were two outcomes. One is that for the first time in my life, I owned who I was. And that may seem strange because I've been successful most of my adult life on several levels. You know, I'm kind of a can-do woman. You know, you think of me in a certain way. I never owned who I was. I was always giving it away. Or looking over my shoulder at who various people seemed to be talking to that couldn't possibly be me. So I turned 60, and I'm realizing there is a there, that there are certain through lines to my life, including courage, that I could own. And the other thing that I learned from this year of research was what I would regret if I didn't do something about it by the end of my life. And that would be that I had never had an intimate relationship. And what I mean by that, I'm not talking about sex, I'm talking about when two whole, actualized people come together and care for each other without leaving themselves behind. I'd never had that. Well, this was a dilemma, okay? I'd made a deal with myself that I was going to not have regrets, and I'm feeling strong. Not strong enough, however, to renegotiate the marriage. That took two more years. You know, and it's interesting, right? I could go to North Vietnam. I could stand up to these various investigations and stuff. But could I say to the man I loved, we need to renegotiate here, I want you to join me on a journey to intimacy? No. I was too afraid that if I did that he would leave me. And of course, I'm single. You know, the thing that many women fear, if I speak my truth, I'm going to end up alone. Except I'm not alone, I'm with myself. It's very different. And I remember the moment when I did speak, and I could see the relationship crumbling in front of me, and I realized, holy cow, this isn't going to go the way I thought. This is ending. And like Virginia Woolf, there was an angel on one shoulder saying, come on, Fonda, you know, chill out, lighten up, he's cute, and, you know, you never have to work. You know, he shares a lot of values with you, you know, come on. And on the other shoulder was another angel saying, Jane, you made a deal. You can die married, but you're not going to be whole. You're going to have regrets. Piss or get off the pot, you know, you got to. And it was terrifying. It was terrifying. It was like it was uncharted territory for me, because I had spent all my life feeling that if I wasn't with an alpha male, that I would cease to be. And it was particularly weird because I left this man and 1,500,000 acres, 27 properties and a private jet to move into my daughter's modest home in a not gentrified part of Atlanta in a little guest room with no closet. Me and my golden retriever. And it was fabulous. Sadness. Yeah, there was sadness at what could have been. A lot of sadness and a lot of anger. And as I said to some women last night, when that anger sets in, write it. Write the letters, but don't send them. You never want to leave concrete proof of insanity. But don't throw them away, because it's fascinating later on when you become, you know, when you become sane again to read, to read. Anyway, it was as though my daughter's house had become the womb in which I was giving birth to my second adulthood. And I could feel it happening. It was a somatic experience. I could feel myself moving back into myself because I had spent 62 years disembodied, as girls and women do when they feel they're not good enough. You just move out. You don't know you've moved out, but you do feel empty and a little bit out of focus. And you notice that this person that other people seem to be looking at only kind of moves back in if you're with women friends, right? I sometimes wondered if this isn't what God is, this filling up with being. And that's when I realized that I had a book to write, and that if I was honest about my journey and its themes, that it would provide a roadmap for other people. One of the things that surprised me is the degree to which men have resonated with my themes. And basically, what is the main theme? The theme is the story of someone who grows up feeling that they're not good enough, that to be loved they have to be perfect, which is a pretty toxic thing to want to be, because nobody's perfect. You know, the goal should be to be complete, not perfect. God is perfect. We should be as good as we can be. We should always try to get better, but we're never going to be perfect. And it affects men differently, but it particularly affects women. And long about adolescence, it attaches itself to our bodies. Our thighs become our Armageddon, or our whatever it is. You know, it's like self-hatred. And that's when girls move out. They move out of themselves. And it leaves emptiness that gets filled with anxiety. And then we do various things to still the anxiety. Mine was food addiction. It can be drugs. It can be alcohol. It can be workaholism. It can be excessive exercise. It can be shopping. Shopping, if I only had that other pair of Manolo Blahniks, then everything would be all right. Or plastic surgery. I've been there. You know, if I just had bigger boobs, then it would be okay. You know, we become so vulnerable to this pressure to be different than we are. Well, this disease to please, it doesn't just go away, it continues on into your relationships. And women tend to turn ourselves into pretzels in order to take care of, please, be what he wants, be what we think we're supposed to be, and so forth. Be good women, good wives. Now, you know, the men, it's different. I'll get to that in a second. But it took me a long time. It actually took me the marriage to Ted, which I really wanted to work. I wanted it to work. And so I was willing to gird my loins and say, I'm gonna heal. I am. I'm gonna get over my fear of intimacy. I had to work real hard. And, you know, but he liked me better before, but that's okay. So what I learned, basically, is that good enough is good enough. I don't mean that we should settle for little, but good enough is good enough in terms of, I'm good enough. I'm good enough. If he can't see it, whoever he or she, you know, screw it. I feel okay. It's hard to get to that place where you feel that good enough is good enough, but so before I started writing the book, I decided that I should try to understand Well, let's start with my father. I should try to understand my father. So I began to read books by Alice Miller, for example, like Breaking the Wall of Silence and The Drama of the Gifted Child and Carol Gilligan and Terence Real. I don't want to talk about it. A lot of books that had to do with male depression, among other things. And I ended up learning about my father and every other man in my life, all of my husbands, my brother, every man I've ever known. Carol Gilligan, in particular, was very important for me. She and her colleagues have done a lot of research. She's famous for the research she did on girls. What people don't know is she has three sons, and she's done a huge amount of research on boys. And let me, in a nutshell, tell you, sum this up. And what this talks to is this issue of girls and women being the agents of change. I've heard this for so many years. Women are the agents of change. Girls, and it was kind of it sounded good. I liked it. I mean, I'd certainly like to believe it, but it was kind of rhetorical. So here's what I learned. What I've just said about girls. Girls tend to lose relationship with themselves at adolescence. They lose their voice. They choose relationship with a boy over relationship with self. Their visible public life becomes quite different than their internal personal life. There's that bifurcation. With boys, it happens at 5, 6, when they first enter public school, when they first leave home, when they first receive implicitly or explicitly these messages. Be a man. Be a real man. Don't be too sensitive. Don't be emotional. Don't be too close to mama. Don't cry. Cry, baby. You know how it goes. And little by little, and this has been well documented, they begin to shut down. They begin to become emotionally illiterate. They begin to become distant. They begin acting out in strange ways. 1 out of 10 boys in this country are on Ritalin. Not always because of this. Sometimes there's real chemical issues, but we throw Ritalin at them because we don't know what else to do. So think what this means. Little boys at 5 years old grow up feeling that they have to match up this gender norm of what it means to be a man. It happens so early in their lives that it's life. It's just, you know, it's inevitable. It's how it is. Girls have a decade before they lose their voice of owning who they are. And if we really, it's one of the great values of writing your biography. I highly recommend it, even if you never get it published. But it forces you to go back and remember. You know, it starts with, and then I did this, and then I did that, and then you have to peel another layer and said, this is how I felt, and then this is how I really felt. And very often girls will realize that they had something early on that they then lost. Not all girls, but enough to where it's, you could almost say it's universal. Sometimes it doesn't happen to girls in adolescence. Sometimes it's just that their mothers, because mothers are basically rehearsals for daughters. You know, the daughters see the mother leaving themselves behind in order to, you know, serve, care for. And so girls think that's the way it's supposed to be, and they do it. But you don't have to scratch so deep with girls and women, and they can remember the before part of it, and they can become angry. Anger is good. Anger brings clarity. They become resistors. With boys, it's so much harder. They grow up, and there's this bifurcation between head and heart. Patriarchy takes aim at girls' voices, but it takes aim at boys' hearts. And that's why I say at the end of my book, what I want to try to do with my life in this third act is to try to help us all, help girls and women reclaim their voice and boys to reclaim their heart. I have a grandson who's about to turn 7, and I mean, I can see him shutting down. We have to work so hard to keep him emotionally literate. You know, just a whole lot of love and, you know, just the things that you can say and not say and all kinds of things. But anyway, and that's why I think that's a kind of a conceptual, a psychological foundation for why I and many other people in this country and in the world, I've traveled the world this year, feel that if we're going to survive, if the planet is going to survive, women are going to have to lead the way. It's going to have to be women. And it's not because it's not because we're morally superior, we just don't have our manhood to prove. And there's so much at stake, isn't there? I mean, those of us, I can tell you're not all students. Some of you are in your third act. And those of us who are in our third act, I think, would agree with me. It's never been quite so bad. It's never been so scary. We've never had real radicals running this country. And I like to think of, the way I see it is that there's a crust of patriarchy surrounding the globe. But if you've ever been to Yellowstone, you've seen the mud bubbling up and the geysers and the steam coming up through the cracks and crevices and the patriarchy. That's us. That's the feminine spirit that is beginning to break through. And it's happening all over the world, in China, in Russia, in India, in Africa, in, you're nodding, Finland, well, you know, the socialist democratic countries. I mean, there's the president of Sweden is a redhead woman who does, for exercise, she belly dances. I mean, is that cool or what? But anyway, I think we have to, as individual women and girls, and as communities of sisterhood, we have to own who we are. We have to understand what's at stake. We have to understand that feminism is nothing less than the movement into whole being for men as well as women, becoming full human beings. We have to lead the way, and everyone will benefit. This is not something that we're doing over. You know, we're not saying we want power over. We're not saying patriarchy has to be replaced with matriarchy. It has to be replaced with democracy. The antithesis of democracy is patriarchy. How can it be democracy when the majority of human beings on Earth are less than? Maybe it's harder for people to see in Santa Barbara, or maybe at least for the people in this room. But if we learn to see, you know, we can see it. And so important to have, I'm so glad that I learned what I've learned about men and about my husbands and about my father, because I can, first of all, I can forgive and I can feel tremendous empathy. It's important for us to feel empathy, to understand that patriarchy harms men as well as women. And that's about it. I don't know how long I've talked. Usually I talk about 20 minutes. They told me tonight I should talk for 45 minutes, but Mickey Flack said talk 30 and then take 30 minutes of Q&A, so I don't know how long. Let me see. Oh, it's been longer than 30. Huh? So I don't know. I'd rather hear what you all have to ask and say. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Okay, I want to hear from this gentleman here. He was nodding a lot.
My name is Robert Mueller. We knew each other at a time when I was a cooperator with Ted Turner. And my recommendation is simply that you should be candidate for Secretary General of the United Nations at the end of this year. Okay.
Thank you.
Because for 60 years, we have not seen a woman as the head of the United Nations.
Yeah, okay? It would be a good idea. I think Ted would approve of the idea of a woman. Not me, but a woman. Yeah. I'm supposed to go over to here. The man with the tie. Hi. Scarf.
I came out to the party and I came out to the lecture.
Thank you.
Because I'm a contemporary and I'm always delighted to come out. Someone my age who's still feisty. But I have to say that I'm positively stunned by your candor, your honesty, your vulnerability. Keep on delivering this message.
Thank
you. Please do, and you'll find that intimacy before the third act.
Thank you. Thank you. Fred.
Thanks for what you, the kind words. You know, I want to speak personally for a second and to get your view of this, but build up this just to say that I'm as concerned as I was during Vietnam about what's happening to the Iraqi people. This torture thing, you know, the Center on Constitutional Rights says that the United States, that Bush is now has 100 torture chambers around the globe, secret torture chambers, which means that we're in a situation now where one man has taken upon himself to arrest and torture anyone he chooses without any of us, and arrest the reporters who report it. That's what they're moving towards. Now, anyway, but I think the key new element that really changes things for me was realizing as I began to look into this that everyone in this room is more likely to die because our present leaders are not only unable to protect us, but increasing the threat to us on every level. I mean, it's unbelievable what's happening. Now, without going into all that for a moment, I am getting towards the question. The point is that when I really get into that space of realizing what's happening, you know, Bob Woodward says we're 1-9-11 away from a police state in this country, and the people we appointed, the two Republican governors, Thomas Keene, James Thompson, to tell us what should we do after 9/11 to prevent new 9/11s, are saying there is going to be another 9/11, and it's going to be worse than far worse than the ones we've had. All of the experts that I've consulted, if you look at the Port of L.A., everywhere in the country, it's unbelievable. He's gone over to Iraq, he's fighting these wars, and they've left us absolutely unprotected here in America.
So is your question, do I agree with that?
No, I'm sorry.
Because I do.
I get going on. Okay. What I'm trying to get through with is all this. So that's how I feel. So I feel like I did during Vietnam on that level. Now, in my third act, at the same time, I'm working on having more of a life, you know, experiencing more being in my life, spiritual development, psychological development. And to go back to that, to the way we were during the Indochina days, running around, yelling, screaming, all that, it's hard for me to do that at this point. I'm wondering how you balance your own desire for personal and spiritual development with your political commitments, how you see that whole issue? Because I have to say, I'm confused about it myself, honestly.
Man, that's a hard one. Did you all hear the question? In essence, it's we're older now, and we're feeling the need for the metaphysical, for the deepening, for the not living laterally but vertically. And how do we balance that with the need to kick ass? I think, you know, I like the way Native Americans view it. There are elders. We are elders. There's certain things that we can't do for all time. I got a new hip and, you know, and we're tired and all things like that. But this hall is filled with young people. And our role is to inspire and motivate and help young people connect the dots. And that's what elders did for me when I was coming. I was already old when I became an activist, but, you know, that's what we have to do. At the different stages of life, we have a different role in the scheme of revolution. And, you know, there are radicals running the country, and it calls for revolution. Now, it's a different notion, in my opinion, than the revolution that we thought was happening in 68 and 69 and 70, because it will be led by women. And women tend to be circular, not hierarchical. And we're not interested in power over. But we do need to. Cindy Sheehan said something at a rally recently. She said, you know, we're preaching to the choir, but not everybody in the choir is singing. So we have to encourage everybody to start singing. And, you know, that can mean having people to your house and showing movies or having discussions or having speakers come and registering people to vote and you know, and having rallies and writing letters to, you know, the things that I said before. There's a lot we can do that we don't have to do it, the same way that we did before. Does anyone want to add anything to that? Excuse me? They were marching today. There were 10,000 people marching today, and some of them are in this room right now. Yeah. Is there anyone? Yeah. No one on there. Okay. Anybody on this side? Are you standing waiting to talk? Okay, speaking to the mic.
Jane, I listened to you on Larry King Live, and one of the things you mentioned was how disturbed you were at the way that women in America held their faces. And what I wonder is, with this wholesale need to do all sorts of plastic surgery, what do you think the women in this country are teaching the young women who are coming up for tomorrow?
Well, the people in Hollywood are teaching them really bad lessons. And that's why I think... There, you know, I have made the decision that I'm not going to carve up myself anymore. And it's hard because I'm 68 and I'm going to go back into movies. But I can say to myself, man, I knew Katharine Hepburn, and if she can do it, I can do it. And I want to... What I said on Larry King was that I've been traveling all around the world, and I go to Finland, Sweden, Australia, and people line up to get their books signed, and they own their faces. Their teeth aren't all capped and whitened, and everything's not all Botoxed, and they are who they are, and it made me so sad for this country. I'm looking at a lot of people who own their faces, and I think it's just great. But in the last few days since I've been here, I've seen a lot that don't. And I'm going to Hollywood tomorrow, and I know I'm going to see a lot that don't. But it's not that way in other countries. And we have to set examples, and we have to, you know, it's good enough is good enough. Mm-hmm. We have to stop worrying about being perfect. We have to just resist. We have to resist in every possible way, including how we treat our bodies and our fear of getting old. We have to embrace it and embrace becoming elders. Yes.
I feel honored to ask you a question. Thank you for being here. You mentioned today in your lecture and also in your book that you were courageous in the political arena, but not in your relationship with men. And for those of us in our second act who are still trying to learn these lessons, how were you able to reconcile those two areas so that you could achieve that balance? And what is it that women need to do so that they don't lose themselves in their relationships with men?
It took me really a long time, like I said. It took me to realize what I had to do when I was 60, and then it took 2 more years to actually do it. One of the reasons I wanted to write the book was because I've never depended on a man financially. So, I mean, it shows how misogyny can enter our DNA without our even knowing it. It's no matter what class, what race, gender distortions and all of that goes deeper than those things. Well, you know, I had therapy. Being rich helps in that way. but consciousness, getting together is, in groups of women can help too. What we have to understand, what did it for me was the understanding, and again, the most important part about writing your autobiography is the research you do on your parents. It's so important to understand who they were or who they are, and even more, who their parents were. What was done to your parents? Were your grandparents happy when your parents were, you know, those kinds of things. I learned some pretty amazing things about my parents. And why is this important? Because you learn it had nothing to do with you. A blanket might have been thrown over you at birth, so to speak, by their issues. And you then spend a good part of your life, and if you're lucky, if it happens in your second act, where you pull the blanket away and say, they did the best they could, poor things. They couldn't really see who I am. But I'm going to become who I am. And then, you know, then there's the issue of survivor guilt as you pass them by. You know, mine are both dead, but it was hard, sort of figuratively thinking, I love you both, bye. You're great, but I'm going further. My father would be stunned by my book. Not because I revealed anything he didn't already know, but because I'm dealing with feelings. He didn't know about feelings. It's a whole generational thing, although there's some men of a certain age here that I can tell are not like my father. But, you know, Norman, you saw the movie. Feelings were terrifying. And anyway, so part of it is discovering who your parents were, who your grandparents were, so you can sort of come into your own and not be dragging their baggage with you. And becoming very intentional about the way we live. You know, the way I entered my third act was very intentional. It was the best decision I ever made. And like somebody said, well, what advice would you give to yourself if you were 24? I said, I'd give them my book. If I read my book when I was 24, I would have done my life differently. I would have been intentional about it instead of like a leaf in the stream sort of going along and hoping that I'd catch on to some guy who would straighten me out. And, you know, anyway, I better not talk anymore. I say really bad things when I... Hi!
Hi. Before I ask my serious question, I was a dear friend of Mike Bloomfield, and I'm wondering if Steel Yard Blues is available in video anywhere. I've searched...
I hope not.
Oh, you do, huh? I love the movie.
You did?
Yeah.
There's maybe three people in the world... that love that movie, Steel Yard Blues. But I don't know if it's available. I have no idea.
Find it.
And I'm not going to try to find out.
Oh, I was actually going to ask you to prod some people to make it available, because I think it isn't. But at any rate, back when you were Hanoi Jane in the Johnson years and in the Nixon years, The U.S. Senate, which I think is a good barometer of the nation as a whole, had quite a few very courageous progressive men: Gene McCarthy, George McGovern, Philip Hart, Wayne Morse, yada yada yada. Now I can see there are only three, and only one of them is going to run for president. And that's Russ Feingold, and there's Barbara Boxer and Tom Harkin, who has already run for president. And I'm wondering why you think that change has taken place. And then I'm wondering if it's related to the change that almost all of us are aware of, which is how damn materialistic the society has become and how really cheesy a lot of the stuff that people work all those extra hours. I mean, maybe it's Thorstein Veblen knows about it in his theory of conspicuous consumption. But why do you think the country's... become so materialistic and the number of really worthwhile and leaders in the Senate have depleted so few?
Well, it has something to do with capitalism. But I also know, I mean, I was married to a capitalist, and I know that it is possible to be a capitalist a humanist capitalist with a heart and with values. You know, it was very interesting kind of looking at the world alongside Ted Turner. Why am I talking about? Oh, yeah, capitalism. Making those decisions. Why they're not more like him, I don't know. And you know, the answer to what to do about it. Dick Flax, you want to say anything? Is that you? Oh, you're right up front. Revolution? I don't know. What do you want to say?
Your wisdom is superior.
Oh, yeah, sure. I tell you what, I mean, it's intimidating to get a question like this when you know that there are people in the audience that really know how to answer it. I'm not wise enough to know how to answer it. You know, I know that one reason that there's less foment now than there was during the Vietnam War is because there's no draft. I mean, there is a draft. It's an economic draft in a way, but there's, you know what I'm talking about. But why we're more materialistic and I don't know. Huh? I thought you said inbreeding. Another thing that I think is very valuable is I went through a period with Tom Hayden where I had no money. Read all about it. That's when I got to know the Flaxes. Who also had no money. And I was very happy that way because, you know, there's a value of coming to conscience late because you're conscious of everything that's, and you know, I was already famous and successful and relatively rich, and then I became an activist. And there was this wall of difference around me. And so when I stopped, I couldn't work. And so I didn't have any money. So I was more like everybody else. And it made me real happy. And I saw that I could live that way. I mean, we lived in a house called, my father called the Shack that had, I mean, it was really something. And it was great. And it's the part of my kids' life that they miss the most. And man, were they pissed when I married Ted Turner. And you know what my son said? My son, who was just about 2 feet tall when we started the camp and who's now a movie star. How many of you saw Barbershop? He was the white guy. And Soldier's Girl, and anyway, he's a wonderful actor, yeah.
What's his name?
Troy Garrity. We didn't want to saddle him with Fonda or Hayden, so we gave him his paternal grandmother's original name, Garrity, a good Irish name. What was I talking about? Oh, yeah, when I married Ted, and Troy was visiting us once, he was about 18, and he woke up one morning, and I came in to bring him breakfast. Well, I did. I brought him breakfast. And he looked at me and he said, I don't want a mother who doesn't work. Anyway, I don't know why people are so lousy, rotten, materialistic, and corrupt. And all I know is that there's a hell of a lot of really, really good people in this country. And I can say it from firsthand experience because I've been out there all over this country. And let me tell you, one vet spit tobacco juice at me and it got a lot of headlines. What they don't report is that inside the halls like this are Vietnam veterans who come because they feel fine about everything. And they felt the same way I did about the war. And by the way, there's a documentary called Sir, No Sir. And when it comes to town, be sure to see it. This is a documentary about the GI movement during the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. This is the part of history that's been abracadabra, like it never happened. And revisionism set in, and what it says to us is, if you were opposed to the war, you were opposed to the troops, and we lost the war because of the anti-war movement and the liberal media, and the troops were all for the war. And what this movie shows is, The army, according to the military historian Richard Heinel, was collapsing from within. It was in a state bordering on collapse, 500,000 desertion, hundreds of fraggings where GIs were trying to kill their officers because they didn't want to be the last man, as John Kerry said, to die for a mistake. And this shows the movement. It's an incredible historical document. And everywhere it shows are Iraq veterans saying, and this is the way it is now. And we have to understand that movement, and we have to support the soldiers that are coming back and their families who are having courageous enough to speak out. And we have to be real clear about the fact that you can oppose a war and support the troops. Sir, no sir. You're too intellectual. I can't deal with you. You're too intellectual. Your only fault is that you like Steelyard Blues. Aside from that, you're way ahead of me, man. I don't know how to answer your questions.
Just why are so few of these good people in politics now?
I beg your pardon?
Why are so few of these good people you talk about in politics now?
Because there's not enough movement. Where's the pressure? We have to rebuild a people's movement from the ground up that will force politicians to become brave. I don't care whether Feingold or Hillary Clinton's elected. If there's no pressure, they're not going to be brave. That was, you know, we always think if somebody really good, like just supposing Feingold or Hillary or somebody does get elected. Well, whoever, somebody that, you know, better, anybody's better. Somebody gets elected. And we're going to think, oh, thank God, it's, you know, it's going to be taken care of. That's when we have the real opportunity to pressure. You know, that's why there was so much gain in California when Jerry Brown was governor, especially in the area of alternative energies. You know, things were really starting to take off because there was a real movement to pressure him. So that's what we need is okay, so your turn is, sit down. Yeah.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah, oh, not really, though, because he just hung around at the mic too long, and he didn't ask a question that time. It's your turn.
All right.
Am I wrong? Oh, well, it doesn't matter. You go.
I grew up in a home where I wasn't supposed to like you, but I've always liked you anyway.
Thank you.
And when you talked about your Christian experience or your conversion, sometimes it doesn't seem to really line up with mainline Christianity, and you've spoken about that a little bit. Can you explain that?
Yes. It's... how can I do this? It's hard. Something happened to me at the end of my second marriage to Tom Hayden. I experienced a pain that I had never known and that I didn't think I was capable of and that I write about in the book, and everyone said stay busy, and I thought no, I'm going to let this wash over me. And I said out loud, I was all by myself in my house, and I said, if God wants me to suffer this much, there's got to be a reason. And I almost did a double take. It's like, who said God? Because I was raised an atheist. I mean, I thought my father was going to strike me dead. But something happened. I could feel it happening. And I remember when we first bought the ranch at the top of the San Marcos Pass, there had been a fire. And after the fire, these flowers began to bloom. And I'd found out that they were a kind of flower that only blooms in the presence of fire. And I kind of felt like something is happening to me that can only happen in the presence of pain. It was like pain was a Trojan horse that had crashed through the armor around my heart and was breaking me open. And things in my life began to change. All these coincidences, you know, like someone giving you the exact book that you need to read at this moment in your life, or the person that you would need to would come into your life. And I heard Bill Moyer then say on some show, coincidences are God's way of remaining anonymous. And that really stuck to me. But I lived in Hollywood, you know, so I was still, it was still secular. But then I moved to Georgia. It's very different there. Ted is an atheist, but all his friends are very devout Christians. Jimmy Carter, Rosalind Carter, Andrew Young. I mean, these are smart, hip, people. And I was with Ted for 10 years and always going to these receptions. And always I would go into a corner with one of these people and talk to them about their faith. And I began to feel that I was being led. I did. And it was the same kind of feeling that had happened when Tom and I split up. And then I decided I was married to Ted. I didn't tell him. I became a Christian. It was not a good thing to do. It was not a nice thing to do, to become a Christian when you're married to an atheist without telling him. But we were not playing on the same team at the time, and he was the head of his debating team at Brown, and I knew that he would talk me out of it, and he would use all these reasons, and I would agree with all of them. You know, the wars and the killings and all the things that have been done in the name of Christianity, and I would agree to all of them, but I felt a need. But anyway, so we split up, and I began to go to Bible study, and I suddenly thought, I've made a terrible mistake. I didn't leave a patriarchal marriage to get into a patriarchal religion. What am I going to do? So I began to study further. I began to study Elaine Pagels and the Gnostic Gospels, and the more I studied, the more I felt, yeah, this is where I want to be, and I need to find out how a feminist can reconcile being in a religion that genders God as male. And I have a lot of catching up to do because I've spent so much of my life without this. I didn't grow up like a lot of people do, just assuming certain kinds of faith. So I'm in theology school. I've enrolled in the Interdenominational Theological Center in Atlanta, which is the largest training center for African-American ministers. And me. I'm the only white student in the school. And it's fantastic. It is absolutely fantastic. It was okay until Monster-in-Law came out because nobody knew who I was, and then suddenly because they went to see J-Lo, so then they knew who I went. It was like, what are you doing here? But it's humbling, and I have professors who are published womanist theologians. And the homework is harder than anything that I ever did before. It's absolutely great. Of course, I'm not in it right now because I'm traveling, but I'm reading and doing studies. And anyway, I'm trying to figure this out. I deeply resent how hard it is to say in the United States today that I'm a Christian. And I hate the fact that the fundamentalists in this country have co-opted Christianity. And it's like God is... It's not enough that God is called a man, but he's a Republican. And I came out as a Christian a year ago with Larry King. So I've been traveling around the country, and I always get asked about my faith. And it is absolutely fascinating to see the reaction in Kansas and Ohio and all these states. What I've discovered is there's a lot of people like me, men and women, progressive feminist Christians who are really angry, and we're trying to build a voice so that we can reclaim it. And, you know, because the more I learn about Jesus, the more I think that he was a feminist and well, no argument about the fact that he was a revolutionary, but had some really important things to say about gender also. Anyway, I could go on, but I mean, at my age to be doing this is sort of strange, but then, you know, everything I've done is kind of strange. But I'm on a journey, and there's a lot of people like me. I don't feel lonely anymore, yeah.
Hi, I'm a freshman here at UCSB, and I was wondering what advice you would give to girls and women who are still in their first act. And,
say that again?
What advice you would give to women and girls in their first act who are trying to find themselves and not lose themselves as they grow older?
Read the book.
Right. Okay, but...
Notice what happens when you tend to fall for the players. This is a real issue. My grandkids go to a wonderful private school in Atlanta called Paideia. And I've been talking to this. It's the only school that would ever ask me to come and talk about gender, but I do. And so boys have asked to meet with me in their groups, and girls asked to. And the boys have this. The boys say, I am a feminist. I am not that kind of toxic masculine type. I'm always the best friend, but the girl always goes for the player. I don't mean the football player necessarily, but the kind of the big, tough, you know, the players, the who don't necessarily treat them well. So partly, why do girls do that? Who is it that you're attracted to? I'm used to talking to younger girls, but I always get asked, how do you know when it's a real relationship? And the answer is, listen to your body. And you can't hear your body if you're drinking or smoking pot. It's true. And what you're going to look for in your body is breathing. When your breath gets shallow, there's something wrong. When your body tenses up, there's something wrong. You know, if girls were encouraged to be embodied and to respect and listen to their body, their relationships would be different. You know, so that's one of the things that I would begin to notice interactions between boys and girls, men, young men and young women, and between young women. Why don't we have each other's backs? One of the big impediments to a feminist movement is that we've bought into this competition stuff. You know, we fight among each other. We have to have each other's backs. And so be real conscious of that, how you treat your friends, how your friends treat you. Who are the bullies, you know, and try to get people to be conscious of how they're behaving towards each other. Living intentionally, living consciously, and not falling for the stereotypes. I've not done any of that, so, you know, it's easy for me. I don't want to sound like wise or self-righteous or anything. I've made all the mistakes, and that's why I can a little bit talk about it. I mean, you can't know the mistakes I've made. Is there anybody on?
Jane, we're going to take two more questions.
A comment and a question. First of all, never apologize for going to Hanoi. It made a terrific difference.
I don't apologize for going to Hanoi. I apologize for being photographed on an anti-aircraft gun.
Yeah.
And that deserves apologies.
But it made a big difference, I think, towards ending the war.
Thank you. A lot of veterans tell me that, too. I appreciate that.
Question. You travel the world. You meet a lot of fantastic people who are coming out of colonialism and tradition and will make a big difference to the global community. What possibilities, or how would you describe the possibilities for sisterhood that we can reach out to, given Americans are pretty ignorant about most of the world, but what have you learned about the women of the rest of the world that we should be thinking about and embracing?
I've learned that we have so much to learn from them. One of the organizations that I love the most is called the International Women's Health Coalition. And what they do is they go to women's conferences and they notice who the leaders are. You know, from Nigeria or from Ghana or from Somalia or from wherever. And they invest in those leaders. And you learn from them. There's so many women and that have so much many more obstacles to overcome than we do, and the inventiveness that they use to overcome them is something that we can learn from. Also, there's an organization called Equality Now that's based in New York that provides legal. They're lawyers all around, feminist lawyers all around the world that provides legal support for women. We're also, Gloria Steinem and myself and Robin Morgan and Pat Mitchell and many other women have started the Women's Media Center. Our office is in the Empire State Building, and part of that has an international component. But You know, I don't know how many of you know that there this right-wing leadership institute in Virginia or Maryland or someplace with like $1 million a month budget, and all the talking heads that you, the right-wing people that, you know, from Rush Limbaugh to all of them, Susan Coulter, they've all come through here. They get trained. What's the message? What's the word? How do you express it? And then they get placed in the media. And they monitor everything. Well, we know what happened with PBS. You know, they monitor every single bad thing that said somebody about Bush, someone calls in and make, you know. Well, we're going to do that. we're going to have rapid response when a story goes out the mainstream news deals with issues like it's gender neutral. It's never gender neutral. You know, one of the most glaring examples is the shootout, the school shootouts, you know, Columbine being the most successful. And then the headlines are all, oh, my God, what's happening to America's adolescents? What's happening to our teens? Uh-uh. What's happening to our sons? These are boys. And unless we recognize it as such, we're not going to be able to solve the problem. Social Security, bankruptcy laws, these all have a very different impact on women, and nobody ever talks about it. And so we want to try to plant stories and, you know, and give the woman's voice to that and create, you know, so it's not just Donna Brazile, but there are many faces and different kinds of women that can get out and talk about our issues, including international issues. Because we have to know what's going on, because there is a huge women's movement around the world. And you're absolutely right. We don't know enough about it. I was in the Beijing Women's Conference. I don't even remember. I think it was 1995. And, oh, my God. You know, one of the central thesis of it was reproductive rights are human rights, and women's rights are human rights. And the impact that this had throughout China, it kind of spread like ether through China. And all of these, you know, these Chinese, it was like, women's rights are human rights. Powerful, powerful. And, you know, this, more and more women are stepping forward in every country of the world, and it's so beautiful, and it's so humbling because they have so many more obstacles, which is both good and bad. It's hard when things aren't quite as obvious as it is in, you know, in the developing world, where women have absolutely no rights at all, and you're real clear about who the enemy is. It's a little bit complicated here, but anyway. We need to know more about what's happening in the rest of the world. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
Oh, Jane. First of all, I just want to thank you, along with, I'm sure, many other women in the audience. I personally lost my after-baby weight due to your exercise tapes, which at that time nobody was doing anything like that, and you let us do it right in our own homes, and that was wonderful. The other thing is I just want to thank you so much for being here with all of us. We have a very small grassroots women's sisterhood in this little town, just started this year. It's called Sisters Inside, and it's for nothing else except to honor women among us who are doing things mm-hmm. for other women, women standing together and listening to other women and recognizing other mm-hmm. women. And one of those other women just told me to please let you know and everybody that there's a women's peace march on Sunday at 2 p.m. at the pier.
On Mother's Day.
Excuse me, Sunday, Mother's Day. Yeah, and you'll be gone, but we would have loved to have had you there. And we would like you to be an honorary member of our Sisters
Inside
Sisterhood.
Oh, I'd love to. Yeah, you're taking
sisterhood.
Back Mother's Day is because it started off for peace.
Yeah. So, yeah. And thank you for coming, being with us tonight.
I appreciate that. Thank you. One more?
Okay. My question actually has to do with the documentary that you mentioned, Sir, No Sir, and the fact that you mentioned earlier about that there's a lot of stuff that we need to know. And it's amazing to me, and it's unbelievable that there was this anti-war movement during Vietnam. And I wonder if you know that if there is a lot of discontent among the soldiers to become such a movement in the
yes,
like there was
Iraq veterans against the war,
and whether that is being muffled. Too.
Well, they're trying to stop all the blogs coming out of Iraq, but they're still coming out. There's Iraq Veterans Against the War, which is modeled after Vietnam Veterans Against the War. There's Vets for Peace, Gold Star Mothers, Military Families Speak Out. I mean, there's a number of them, and they're growing.
Because I think that would be a big difference.
Yes, because, you know, you'd think they would be unassailable. You would think that Cindy Sheehan was unassailable, but it's just amazing what they do to her. There's a friend of mine whose father is extremely Republican and lives at Hope Ranch, I guess. Is that what it's called? Yeah? And he sent her a letter that he received, which I guess gets sent around to Republican, you know, givers or something. And it was this letter that said, Cindy Sheehan was married twice. And Casey, the son that was killed in Iraq, was from the first husband. And when they split up, Cindy abandoned her son. She never raised Casey. The first husband did. I mean, it was very persuasive. Totally untrue. Totally untrue. She was never married two times. She never gave up her children. You know, none of it. It's like some, you know, they spread lies about me. Just complete lies. So, yeah, I mean, they're, you know, what did they call the Vietnam veterans who spoke at the Winter Soldier investigation? Alleged veterans. Alleged veterans. I mean, look what they did to John Kerry. I mean, it takes such courage to volunteer to go and serve your country. To go and then discover that it is a lie and have the courage to come back and speak that truth. Putting yourself in harm's way for a second time, that takes a special kind of hero, I think. And what those veterans... I was at the Winter Soldier investigation. It took place in Detroit in 71 at the Howard Johnson Motel. There were about 150 veterans from every military branch of the military testified to atrocities they had committed. In the wake of My Lai, they wanted to show this is going on. And our officers know it. You know, James Lipton, he was a psychologist that dealt with a lot of veterans. We put them into an atrocity-producing situation. And these men spoke, shaking and weeping, speaking their truth. And it was a spiritual experience. And I realized these men are experiencing redemption by speaking their collective truth. They are asking this nation to hear them and to join them in redemption, and we couldn't do it. And we couldn't do it because the makers of history that are in office right now have prevented us from understanding who they are. That's what the whole Swift Vote for Truth thing was all about. You know, they wanted to make Kerry and others seem like, you know, they weren't patriotic or something. We were offered an opportunity to be redeemed as a nation. There'll be another one coming along, and we have to take it, and we have to hear what these men have to say. We'll end on that note. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.